Hi, everyone. We just wanted to let everybody know that we've joined the call. Journalists and speakers are now on the line. We are going to give this, obviously, just a few more minutes to make sure that everybody...
Scott Martell from the LA Times.
Hi, this is Jessica Piccolo from RH Reality Check.
Billy Courier, Center for American Progress.
Hey, Billy.
Hey, Scott.
This is David Lyle. I'm on, but obviously not speaking.
It is. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. We will give this just a couple more minutes to get everybody called in before we start, but we will be starting in just a couple minutes. Thank you for your patience.
Eric Ekholm.
Arnold Hamilton.
Tony Morrow.
Sarah Knight.
Yourself.
Thanks, everyone, for your patience. We're going to give this just one more minute to get a couple more folks on the call, and then we'll start. Thank you very much for your patience. Okay, we'll go ahead and get started. Good morning, everyone. My name is Scott Swenson. I work with Rethink Media and manage the Money and Politics and Fair Courts Collaborative. Today, we are joined by a panel of experts, legal scholars, and advocates in the field of judicial independence and fair courts, responding to the not only the tragic events in Oklahoma this week, but what is really seen as the politicization of the courts and what is happening to our independent judiciary. We have five speakers, each of which will be speaking for between 3 and 4 minutes, and then we will get to questions from the journalists. Our first speaker today is Brian Stevenson, the Executive Director of the Equal Justice Institute. Brian?
Good morning. In 1937, Oklahoma had its last scheduled execution of multiple offenders in a single day. That 1937 execution came after decades of lynchings, racialized lynchings, that were widely condemned as lawlessness and the use of punishment for political power that abused the rights of many minorities. After the 1937 execution, Oklahoma had a death penalty that was characterized by unreliability, racial discrimination, and unfairness. It wasn't just Oklahoma, but most states. And that's what led the United States Supreme Court in 1972 to strike down the death penalty in Furman versus Georgia. The court concluded that the death penalty in this country was lawless, arbitrary, discriminatory, and fueled by political passions that did not protect the rights of the accused. In 1976, the court allowed states to reinstate the death penalty based on a promise, and the promise was that states were going to commit to heightened scrutiny, rigorous and consistent compliance with due process, and ensure that no execution violated the Eighth Amendment's prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. In the last year, the state of Oklahoma has abandoned that commitment. They have broken that promise, not only to the court, but to the people in Oklahoma and this nation. They have allowed unreliability, unfairness, and a kind of lawlessness to undermine their death penalty procedures. There have been serious questions about methods of execution that have undermined the appropriateness of some of these executions, including one in Oklahoma where a man was used with these compound pharmaceuticals in a way that resulted in serious doubts that he was executed in a humane manner. That's what led lawyers to challenge the protocols being used in Oklahoma. Rather than do what they promised in 1976, the state legislature actually adopted statutes invoking terms like state secret to shield information about how executions were going to be carried out and implemented, not only from the accused, but from the people of Oklahoma. They have basically chosen no transparency, no accountability, no even explanation about how they're going to carry out executions. A judge in Oklahoma found this to be unconstitutional, found it to be a breach of the commitment that the state made in 1976, and declared that this process should not move forward. Rather than do what courts are obligated to do, which is to ensure the rule of law, courts in Oklahoma refused to do so. When the Oklahoma Supreme Court finally intervened, they were threatened and challenged by politicians, including the governor and the attorney general, with impeachment. It is precisely this environment where compliance with the rule of law is met with threats and intimidation and calls for impeachment that creates a situation that many, I think, have fairly characterized as a constitutional crisis. The ultimate execution that was cruel and unquestionably barbaric and inhumane is tragic not only for the men and women awaiting execution in Oklahoma, not only for the people of Oklahoma, but I think for the system of law. And it sets up a very serious set of questions that have to be answered about what the death penalty is doing in Oklahoma, what it's doing to the courts, and the way in which we're using it. We often talk about the death penalty as being something that is decided by whether someone who commits a terrible crime deserves to die. The real question in capital punishment is whether we deserve to kill. And I think the events in Oklahoma over the last several weeks and months have revealed a state that does not deserve to be imposing these kinds of punishments when it compromises the rule of law and creates the kind of constitutional crisis that we've seen.
Thank you very much, Brian. Our next speaker is Caroline Fredrickson, President of the American Constitution Society. Caroline?
Well, thank you. Thank you, Scott. And I think Brian did a wonderful job of introducing the subject. I'm going to expand a little bit on the issue of the role of the courts. I think there has been a lot of very important attention, very incisive coverage of the issue of the lethal drugs and the terrible consequences of the way that the Oklahoma officials went forward. But I want to talk a little bit more about what Brian has said about rule of law issues in the court. And I think one of the things that hasn't been given quite as much coverage is that, in fact, that this constitutional crisis was really one in which we had politicians trying to bully the courts into giving them the outcome that they wanted. I would say, that this has been a common experience in recent years where our courts are supposed to play a role in checks and balances ensuring that the elected officials do the right thing and follow the Constitution. But in this case, not only did Oklahoma's politicians refuse to let the courts do their job, but they did more than put their thumb on the scales of justice. They really put their entire bodies on one side and pulled it out of balance. And I think, you know, we need to recognize that this kind of intimidation is dangerous and undermines our system of separation of powers. And, you know, I think we are rightfully very proud of having an independent judiciary, but what's happened in Oklahoma really puts that to the test. When you have the legislature introducing impeachment proceedings against five Supreme Court justices and suggesting that they had done the wrong thing regarding their application of the Constitution, and that their decision, which he didn't agree with, should be considered a violation of the oath of office because it constitutes a willful neglect of duty and incompetence, is really outright intimidation. And it really does undermine the idea that we have a court system that is meant to keep the elected officials in check and make sure that they are following the Constitution. And what happens instead is that the justices get bullied, they reverse their decision, and we had the execution of Clayton Lockett in the miserable fashion that it happened. So now as the politicians in Oklahoma are scrambling, they're pointing fingers, they're trying to figure out what happens next in order to deal with executions going forward, the irony is that our system actually has a method for resolving these sorts of issues, fair and impartial courts. But whether Oklahoma can recover from this debacle is unclear. As Andrew Cohen has written, Oklahoma has neutered its Supreme Court. And as we've seen, you can't really just snap back into rule of law mode once you've suggested that the courts don't have play this role in checks and balances and making sure that they are really the impartial arbiter of these kinds of constitutional disputes. And it's not just Oklahoma. According to the National Center on State Courts, this attack on the Oklahoma justices marks the fourth time in 4 years that state high court justices have been threatened with impeachment over their role in deciding cases. We have these courts because they're supposed to resolve some of the most difficult issues that we face as a nation in a way that's uninfluenced by majorities, by popularity, by elections. And whether that's for gun owners or property owners or criminals, the criminally accused, these are issues where people are very divided and there's not always the popular decision to be made. But that's what checks and balances are about. That's what separation of powers is about. And our judges should be and must be accountable to the Constitution. They must carry out their obligation to behave honestly, ethically, and dispense impartial justice. And if they do not, they can and should be removed from office. But politicians and interest groups who attack judges and call for their impeachment because they don't like the outcomes of cases not only do our system a grave disservice, they threaten to dismantle it. So as in Oklahoma, the politicians didn't make these thorny problems that we all face and must resolve just go away. They just put them in a different arena and took them out of the appropriate place where they should be decided in the fair and impartial court. So I want to close with simply saying that I think one of the things that I hope those who are covering this issue will take away is that not only are there significant questions about the death penalty and its administration, but we really have to go back and examine what's happening to our courts and ensure that they continue to thrive and serve the vital role that they do in a functioning democracy.
Thank you, Caroline. The next speaker will be Bert Brandenburg, Executive Director, Justice at Stake.
Good morning, and thanks, Scott. I'm going to expand a little bit on what Caroline was just saying and talk about how, unfortunately, Oklahoma, as bad as it's been for the courts, does fit into a larger upsurge of bullying against the courts around the country. And so in addition to what's been going on there, we've seen recently, for example, in Missouri, a bill moving forward in the legislature to allow state officials, including judges, to be sued for enforcing federal gun laws and to be banned for life from their jobs if they ever enforce a law that were ultimately found unconstitutional. In Kansas, a law was just passed taking away the authority of the state Supreme Court to pick chief district court judges and also weakened their authority over budgeting. This was described as political payback because of some friction over some cases that the legislature did not like. In North Carolina, I think you're going to hear more in a few minutes about how judicial elections are playing into this, but we're seeing a $1 million primary in an election context where special interest groups are just pouring enormous amounts in to kind of push judges around. In Tennessee, we're seeing a debate over whether the state should abandon its longstanding nonpartisan merit selection system and move to either contested elections or another system that would make it more politicized. And there's already talk of taking the retention elections for judges this fall and or rather this summer and turning those into a really much more political referendum over political issues. In Ohio, we've seen a state legislature pushing to impeach a federal judge over a marriage equality decision. In Iowa a few years ago, after a decision that all seven justices of the Supreme Court signed on to unanimously upholding marriage rights, in that state you had not only three of those justices unseated, but the other four threatened with impeachment for simply signing on to the unanimous decision. And we've seen similar efforts in Massachusetts and New Jersey. I want to briefly go back about 10 years because this reminds me of something that went on about 10 years ago that's worth thinking about in terms of whether this is going to get worse. About 10 years ago, you had this spasm of attacks on the federal courts in Washington, D.C., where you had groups holding what were called Justice Sunday rallies, where they would talk about impeaching judges they didn't like. You had the Terri Schiavo case, where the Congress, because of interest group pressure, passed a law manipulating one case in a state court just because interest groups didn't like the decision. And you had the judge in that case, Judge Greer, a Florida state court judge who was doing his job. He had to get U.S. Marshals to protect him just to walk his dog. You had as well talk show hosts whipping up impeachment threats against state judges in Vermont and Ohio over individual decisions they'd made about criminal sentencing. So I'm reminded of 10 years ago. I do think the smell of bullying justice is in the air. The fear is that whether this will trigger a new upsurge in bullying, and regardless of what happens today or tomorrow, the courts in general do face a more permanent infrastructure of attacks on their work and on their livelihood. It's political consultants, it's talk show hosts, it's legislators, and unfortunately it won't be going away by itself.
Thank you, Bert. Our next speaker is Alicia Bannon, Counsel Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Alicia?
Thanks so much. I'm going to talk about what happened in Oklahoma is part of a larger trend in terms of targeting judges for decisions that they've made on the bench, particularly in criminal cases. Just last week, we saw a sitting judge in North Carolina on the North Carolina Supreme Court targeted with an attack ad criticizing her for not being tough on child molesters. And this is a dynamic that is only going to be getting worse, and I'm going to talk about this particularly from the perspective of judicial elections. You know, in recent years, we've seen a flood of special interest money pouring into state Supreme Court races, and you know, interest groups are trying to shape who sits on these courts and the decisions that they make. And what we've seen is that this money often goes towards ads attacking judges' criminal records, even when the interest group is focused on business issues or other unrelated issues. And what's troubling about this trend is that it puts judges on notice that if they rule in favor of criminal defendants, they may be setting themselves up for an attack in the next election. And research is suggesting that judges are getting that message. Studies have found that judges give harsher sentences in election years. An Equal Justice Initiative study found that judges were more likely to override juries and impose the death penalty in judicial election years, something I'm sure Brian Stevenson can talk to you more about, and I'm sure Billy will talk about a recent study by the Center for American Progress finding troubling correlations between spending in judicial elections and decisions that courts were making in criminal cases. And, you know, we're seeing more of a shift towards interest groups spending money directly on television advertisements, and with that trend, I expect that this is only going to get worse. You know, we saw a record level of independent expenditures in 2012, and what we've seen is that when interest groups spend money directly on advertisements, those advertisements are much more likely to go negative. And so I think this rise of targeting judges for decisions in criminal cases. The rise of misleading attack ads is something that is unfortunately looks primed only to continue. You know, in the end, we need our judges to be deciding cases based on the law, not because they're afraid of losing their jobs. And what I think is so troubling about, you know, what we saw in Oklahoma and what we're seeing in this in the judicial election context is real pressure on judges to move away from their role of deciding cases based on the Constitution.
Thanks, Alicia. Our final speaker is Billy Korer, Director of Research, Legal Progress at the Center for American Progress. Billy?
Yes, thank you, Scott. I really just want to echo some of the concerns that have been made by the other speakers. One thing that I will point out is that even though this high-profile case really may have encouraged legislators to go further, Oklahoma legislators have been trying to exert more control over the state Supreme Court for years now. These efforts really intensified last year after the court struck down a tort reform bill in June. After that, Governor Phelan called a special legislative session just to pass another tort reform bill. And when she did that, one state senator even came out and said that the special session would focus on, quote, attacking the judiciary, end quote. And at the time, the Tulsa World newspaper also noted that Governor Phelan had received more than $700,000 in campaign contributions from the healthcare industry, which would clearly benefit from any tort reform legislation. And these campaign donors, the same ones who would benefit from tort reform, would also benefit from a state Supreme Court that would uphold the tort reform bill. But unfortunately for Governor Phelan, her criticism of the tort reform decision didn't really lead to any changes for the court. But after the events in recent days, Oklahoma legislators seem to be resorting to the soft-on-crime angle, which is guaranteed to get voters' attention. And as Alicia just mentioned, special interests are using these kind of attack ads in judicial elections all around the country. They're exploiting rulings in criminal cases to get the judges that they prefer elected to the bench. And these attack ads, they often use cases that are similar to the ones that are at issue in Oklahoma right now. They often have gruesome murders of women or children, and they often have black defendants. So these cases were really perfect if legislators were looking to use criminal cases to push the courts to do what they want, basically. And Alicia mentioned our report from 2013 that looked at hundreds of criminal cases in seven states with judicial elections, and we found that state Supreme Courts rule more often for prosecutors and against criminal defendants during big money judicial elections. And this suggests that judges are succumbing to political pressure to appear tough on crime, and the rights of criminal defendants are just collateral damage in this political battle. Yeah, it seems to me like in Oklahoma, the legislators are really taking a page from the playbook of special interests who exploit criminal cases. And I think, like Bert and Caroline said, they're bullying judges to get the results that they want. And the justices in Oklahoma face retention elections, which means that voters decide whether to keep them in office, just a yes or no vote. And the death penalty has played a key role in justices losing retention elections in California and Tennessee. One last thing I'll say about the Oklahoma Supreme Court's jurisdiction over these cases. The Oklahoma Supreme Court was criticized for infringing the authority of the Court of Criminal Appeals. But one thing that I think hasn't been emphasized enough is that the Court of Criminal Appeals repeatedly said it didn't have jurisdiction. So the Supreme Court was really the only place that these inmates could turn. And, you know, after many days of back and forth between the two courts, the justices on the Supreme Court acted, and now they're paying the price. Thanks.
Thank you, Billy. Before we get started with the questions, I just wanted to let everyone know that this call is being recorded today, and we will have a link to the full recording for any journalists who didn't make the call shortly after this call is completed. Everyone's line should be unmuted now. If you are in a noisy area or you need to mute again for any reason, please just press star 6 and then star 6 again to unmute to ask a question. And at this time, with all lines open, if anyone would like to start with the first question, we will be happy to entertain that.
Does anybody have a question that they'd like to ask any of the panelists?
Yes, I do. My name is Bob Sands. I'm with Public Television in Oklahoma. I've heard a lot of talk here in this conference call about the problems and the bullying. So what do we do about this? How does the public come to understand what game is being played here? How do you rectify the situation?
I'll start. This is Bert Brandenburg. There's not a fast answer. This is a long, slow process of public education. It's raising the word like we're trying to do right now, letting people know what's going on. The good news is that people's values are in a pretty good place. They just don't tend to know that this type of bullying is going on. When they face it squarely, they tend to reject it. So the Schiavo bill I mentioned before, you know, it got passed very quickly, but once the public heard about it, they overwhelmingly disapproved of it. When anti-court referenda are put on the ballot to tamper with, say, judicial selection systems, voters quite frequently will say no, you know, don't mess with my courts. The problem is that a lot of what we're describing too often goes on under the radar, and it's really a matter of getting more and more public attention to it. The public is going to be pretty good to the courts. They have good instincts. They just need to know about the problem.
Well, if I could jump in here, too. This is Caroline Fredrickson. I agree exactly with Bert. I do think, you know, generally, you know, we have a system where in many states where there's merit selection, where there's not an election process, you know, in some cases where you have a retention election. And I think it's important to sort of review the amount of politics that takes place in each particular situation. And well, thankfully, you know, in the case of merit selection and where there are retention elections, there it happens less frequently. I think, you know, we need to sort of examine the whole idea of how we appoint justices, not saying that there is one absolute perfect way, but certainly limiting the ability to use the political process to influence the decisions they make in individual cases where some person's constitutional rights are at risk, or many people's. I think it's just is something that we need to remind the voters, remind the general public of what the role of the courts is. And again, as Bert says, it's not a simple answer, but I think people generally understand that courts are supposed to be independent, and we need to reiterate that at every possible moment.
Yeah, this is Billy Courier, and if I could just say really quick, I totally agree with those comments, and I would also say that we need voters to let the legislators know how they feel about these issues. You know, once they do find out about these problems, they need to let their legislators know that they want the legislators to keep their hands off the courts. They need to let the legislators know that impeaching judges for decisions they don't like is not okay.
We're ready for the next question. If someone is ready to ask the next question, please do so. Okay, if there are no other questions, I will just say thank you to the journalists and to the speakers on this call today. As I mentioned, there will be a recording of this call made available shortly thereafter this call is completed. And that concludes today's call. Thank you very much.
Thank you.